Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the sorrows and terrors of a troubled childhood haunt the lives of adults? And what does it take to confront, forgive, and even love a parent who was physically and mentally abusive? Writer Anthony Swofford earned wide acclaim and considerable wealth for his best-selling memoir of serving as a U.S. Marine in the First Gulf War. Jarhead was a New York Times bestseller upon publication and a successful movie later. But while Swofford enjoyed the fast money, easy sex, and copious drugs afforded by his new fame, he remained deeply troubled by the legacy of abuse at the hands of his father, a man with his own legacy of childhood sorrow, infidelity, and a young adulthood shaped by war. Swofford writes about all this in his new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Anthony, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So ultimately, this story arrives at what you call your reverse midlife crisis, where you're the world's only 40-year-old guy longing for like a family in a station wagon. But for a while after Jarhead came out, you were enjoying this sort of no-limits existence. Did that feel wrong to you at the time?
Yeah, I did enjoy the lack of limits that I put on myself, and that I think others allowed me. I was in my early and mid 30s, living in New York City, and living a bachelor's life, and the emptiness of that really began to take a toll on me at the end of that decade.
Mm-hmm.
And much of what I'm looking for in this book and in the writing of it, and while I'm on these three RV trips with my father, is to make sense of that behavior and to stop it, and also to make sense of my history as a Marine and my life as a veteran.
It's interesting, too, throughout the book, you're grappling with your father's insistence that you are very much like him. And according to certain facts of your life, in fact, you are, but always you're insisting that you are not like him.
Right. I guess that's the rub, and that's, the great irony is that my father did this thing when I was in my 20s, which is really inadvisable, and that was he decided that that he should be my pal, and that part of being my pal would be letting me know about his own success, his own amorous successes throughout his life, and of course he was married to my mother during this time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really bad move on his part. I lost a lot of respect for him, and we'd already had a kind of a troubled relationship, and this only increased that trouble. And I wanted so much to not be like my father, but like many men, I became much like him, in fact. And I would have told you that that's not what I was doing, but in fact, it was.
Yeah, there's one point where your father is—he talks about wanting to relate to you as an adult, and you guys can share the fact that you had enjoyed these different dalliances. And you're saying, "Well, I was nothing like you. I wasn't married at the time." But there are human beings behind the casual relationships that you had, who clearly, in certain instances, were hurt by your actions.
Sure, I hurt people. I was hurt. I mean, we were all consenting grown-up adults, and
yeah.
I did. I was dishonest and deceitful in some love affairs, and I'm not proud of that, but I needed to write on, if I was going to write this book honestly, I had to out myself and write the truth. And in fact my father was right when he said, look in the mirror, you're my son, you look like me. And I think he took great pleasure in some ways in sort of forcing me to recognize that I had begun to behave like he had.
Tell us about your dad's young life. He served in Vietnam. He had children. Tell us a little bit about his biography, if you would.
Yeah, my father grew up in the South in Georgia, and the worst possible wound I think that could ever happen to a child happened to him when he was a month old. His mother died from complications of childbirth, and that marked my father. It marks him today. He's nearly 71 years old, and the grief of that and that loss is, the original and the worst sort of loss. And then he had a pretty tough upbringing in a kind of big family in the South, and joined the military to escape that, and ended up in Vietnam with a wife and two kids back home in California. And I was actually, conceived when he was on R&R in Honolulu from Vietnam. And so warfare and the Vietnam War really marked my childhood. And I didn't know it at the time, of course, but, you know, my father, I know from my mother that our family life took a radical shift post-Vietnam. And especially when I was around 8 or 9 years old and our family had come back from a few years of living in Tokyo. And then my father really just kind of disengaged from the family. And I think that Vietnam is definitely responsible for that. My father, I think my father probably had PTSD, what we call PTSD today. Mm-hmm. And it went untreated. He didn't seek help. And I think he also made the mistake, a mistake that I made too, which was not seeking the company of other veterans and people who'd lived similar lives and who could, normalize what is, by most accounts, not really normal, you know, going off to war and coming home with that.
You know, that disengagement is so interesting because there are some really clear instances of abuse that you recount in the book. But you also have this passage where you write about the fact that on weekends, your dad would sleep as late as possible and then he'd stay in his bedroom until late in the morning, just essentially, in your view, to stay away from the family. And as a parent myself, I mean, people could gloss over that and not get it, but I think it would be devastating to a child to feel like their parent is quite literally avoiding them.
Yeah, we really felt like that, and I was in a discussion with my older sister recently, and what we had in our home was we had two different homes, and there was the home where when my father was at work or gone, it was pretty lighthearted, and my mother ran the house then, and there was goodness and lightness and fun and laughter, and then there was this radically different home when my father was present, and it was about keeping quiet and not upsetting our father, and that's very confusing for a kid, and very luckily I'm now a father, and I can't imagine that kind of behavior.
I wonder, as you choose the kind of parent you want to be, if your greatest fear is that your daughter someday will be afraid of you at some point.
Yeah, I will make sure that my daughter is not afraid of me. I was afraid of my father. I know that my my older brother was, and my sisters were. And I'll make certain that the home that I raise my daughter in, with my wife, is one of love and lightness and laughter.
What makes the story so complicated is that you tell it to us at a time when, as you mentioned, your father is 71, he has COPD, he is quite frail at this point in his life. And so you're still grappling with the legacy of all of this, despite the fact that now, at least physically, he can't do anything to you.
No, he can't. And I have to give my father a lot of credit because these RV trips and this reconciliation was his idea. The term "get the venom out," that was his term, and he was right to recognize that I had a lot of venom, that I was still angry. I was in my late 30s, and I was still angry. And I was angry with him for the kind of father he'd been and the kind of husband. And I thought that he had deceived my mother and deceived us children. I was also angry. My older brother died of cancer in the late 90s, and I was completely dissatisfied and even embarrassed by the way my father acted around my brother's death. And,
He didn't go to the funeral.
Yeah, he didn't go to my brother's funeral. My brother died over about 11 months. He was sick for 11 months, and my father only visited him once during that period and then didn't attend the funeral, which I thought was a very cowardly act and that brought shame on me and my family. We have a big, big family, and everyone was at my brother's funeral except my father.
You tell us the story that after your brother died, his widow said to you, "I want you to have his gun, and when our son is old enough, I want you to give it back to him," and you didn't want to take it.
No, I didn't want to take his weapon. I loved weapons when I was in the Marine Corps. I knew them very well. I knew how to use them. But I knew they were dangerous, and I also knew that I was in a precarious psychological state, and I just didn't want a gun around. I had different bouts of depression that were sometimes severe and sometimes not, and that sometimes moved into the realm of suicidal ideation, and I didn't want the means. I guess, you know, one thing that the people who try to prevent people from taking their lives talk about a lot, especially veterans, is means restriction. If a guy is in trouble, just make sure he doesn't have weapons around. And so I made sure to take those steps myself.
It's interesting because I think it seems like people can respond in different ways to suddenly feeling as if they might want to end their lives. Some people are alarmed. Some people are describe the sense that somehow they find comfort in that. Did you feel differently about your suicidal ideation depending on the circumstance?
Yeah, it would depend on the circumstance. Absolutely. When these feelings first crept up on me, I was surprised by them and kind of alarmed and tried to take stock of how I'd landed there, and it was confusing for me. It may have been my brother's death, which was hugely devastating.
Mm-hmm.
May have been my time in the Marine Corps. I wasn't sure. May have been unhappiness with where I was. I was still kind of slogging my way through my undergraduate degree and wanted to be a writer and wasn't sure if I had what it took. And then as I post the publication of my first book, those episodes took on a darker and moodier tenor, and they scared me enough that I went after some talk therapy for myself, and which I needed.
Did you have friends who said, "Anthony, we're worried about you," or were you on the surface having such a great time that nobody was concerned?
I had one very dear close friend who saw me regularly and who said, "Hey, you need to put the brakes on here." But most people, who knew me and even who knew me well, just thought, Tony's having kind of a blast, and why not? He's in his 30s, he can. But a few people who knew me very well, were honest with me and starkly honest with me about my behavior.
You had one incident toward the beginning of the time when you were really kind of going crazy, very wild, when you could have been arrested for driving without a license. And you write about the fact that you've wondered a million times how your life would have been different if, in fact, that one night you were prevented from going forward with this affair that you were having.
Yeah, I didn't have a license at the time, and I was driving a rental car rented by this woman that I just met in Los Angeles. And, we were hanging out on the beach in Malibu, and this cop stopped us. And I shouldn't have been driving. If the cop had pushed the matter, he may have, booked me that night for driving without a license. But he didn't. And then I went on to have, a messy love affair with this woman and moved to New York City for her, essentially, and sort of began my downward spiral. And it all started that night in Malibu, when I didn't have a license to drive.
My guest is novelist and memoirist Anthony Swofford. He is the author of the book Jarhead, which also was made into a movie several years later. We're talking this hour about his new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of moments. If you would like to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Anthony Swofford. His new memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Anthony, to what extent did your father's military career, and particularly his memories of Vietnam, shape your view of what it meant to be a man?
Very, very much so. This essential, you know, mystery. I think fathers are mysterious, you know, for all sons, but the essential mystery of my father was his Vietnam service, and it was something that he didn't talk about very often. Only there were a couple stories that he told, but it was something that he didn't share with us much. And if occasionally a GI buddy would come over, and if he was one of the Vietnam guys, they'd always go outside and they'd sit on the deck and talk, and it wasn't something that I could be a part of. And I think also, you know, children are smart. They're intuitive, and I just knew that this thing called Vietnam had shaped my father, and also had kind of made him a man in some ways. And I was a young kid, certainly in love with my father, looked up to my father, also feared him. And I think part of that fear had to do with this notion of military service.
So did that cause you to join the Marines yourself?
It did, absolutely. And, again, wanting to not be like my father, but becoming my father had been in the Air Force, but had been in combat. And he didn't want me to join the military. The first time I, of my own accord, invited a recruiter over, my father escorted the guy out of the house. But of course, you know, this made me only want to join the Marine Corps even more, and to get after and find that mysterious thing about my father, which I thought was combat service.
And one thing that you write that you and your father shared was what you call the, and this is a quote, the wickedly exciting and doggedly exhausting knowledge that you had flirted with death and won. I think I can understand the exciting. Talk about the exhausting.
Well, for me, the exhaustion was it alters your idea of consequences and barriers and I was able to live my life in a way that I thought there weren't consequences. And my father was a deceiver. He deceived his wife and he deceived his family. And I think I recognized in myself later that living through combat, it's exhilarating. It's an event that can never be replicated. The adrenaline rush, the excitement, the fear, the heroics, the cowardice, that can never be found in the civilian world. And what I found myself doing was trying to find that in ways that ended up being dangerous, driving my fast car way too fast, experimenting with drugs and using alcohol and using love relationships as something where I tried to replicate that combat high.
Do you consider yourself an addict today?
No, I think I was addicted more to the behavior than to any substance. Mm-hmm. But it's been about 2 years now since I pulled myself out of that and had indeed what you said at the top of the show was this. This reverse midlife crisis, where it happened. In fact, in Texas, it happened. I was on a road trip with my father from Atlanta, heading west, and we were just west of Houston. And I had what can only be called an epiphany when I went for a run and really thought I'd had a heart attack there on the side of the road in August, a very hot day, and I was. I saw my father in his RV, and he's sick now with emphysema, and he's living this kind of fantasy of himself, this kind of Clint Eastwood character on the road, stoic. But what I saw was a lonely old guy who was without a partner in his life, and who was probably going to die alone. And it scared me to death. And I realized that I needed to straighten out my life. And that's when this, I'd already wrecked a sports car. I'd gone through a bunch of money, and I'd lived the midlife crisis. And I wanted a family and a station wagon.
In the beginning of the book, you write about the end of this earlier affair, and you write, this woman leaves and you never see her again. And then that's 2010. So I wonder how you can be sure, and in particular, sure enough to write about all this, that you really are done with that part of your life.
Well, I'm certain of it. And writing the book was a way of making certain.
Mm-hmm.
I do my best thinking, and I think indeed probably some of my best living when I'm working. And I've written this book now, and I've outed myself in terms of some behavior, but I've come out of it, and I'm living a radically different life. I am married. I do have a child. I believe that fatherhood is now the great test for me, and being a true and faithful husband. And I believe in myself, and I believe in the idea of family and the idea of quality family life and the great value that that will have, not just for me and my wife, but also for our daughter.
There's no question that you communicate in the book how much you absolutely adore your wife and are just, stunned by the miracle of your daughter. And I know that when you've been interviewed about this before, people keep asking you about when your father will read the book and if you'll send him a copy and what he thinks. I'm curious about, clearly you've already thought, at what point will my daughter be able to read about her father in this way?
Yeah, I hope she'll never read this book.
But, she's going to want to because you don't want her to.
Yeah, of course, right? Well, at least she won't go off and join the Marine Corps. My wife was one of my readers on this book, and we had this conversation a few times, and she said, someday she'll be sitting at college or something, and she'll find that book, and she'll crack it open, and what on earth are we going to say to her? Or what on earth are you going to say to her? I guess I'll just say, I love you dearly, and I lived a life, before you came into my life that was quite contrary to fatherhood and a family, and I hope that I've raised you so that you don't make those same kinds of mistakes and don't live the same kind of life, and that you see that, what's really important is goodness and happiness and equilibrium.
So tell us a little bit more about these trips with your father. I mean, it seems like a bad idea to get into an RV, which is, 40 feet long, and go for hours on end locked in a metal box with someone you sometimes can't stand.
Yeah, it seems like a very bad idea, right? I don't know if you've ever driven a Winnebago or been inside of one, but it's kind of like, hurdling yourself down the freeway inside of your own little earthquake. Things are shaking, and it seems like it's coming apart at the seams constantly. When I told friends about this initial trip from Northern California to Billings, Montana, and they looked at me like I was crazy, and in fact said, "Are you crazy? You're going to jump in an RV with your father?" And they knew the condition of our relationship. But I have to give my father a lot of credit, because he made the first move. And when we were, it was the middle of the night, and we were probably about 10 hours into this trip east of Wells, Montana, and I was driving and exhausted, and my dad reached out and grabbed my arm, and he said, "Hey, son, let's talk. Let's clear the air. I think we need to clear the air," which was the understatement of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, "Are you crazy? Like, well, now? Why now?" And we didn't work things out on that trip. But I did come to see the RV as this place. In the book, I call it a truth machine for my father. It's a place where he's not held in by the confines of home. And there's the road, and it's, my father loves America and loves the road and loves national parks. It was how we spent our vacations as a kid. And it was for him a place of freedom, but I also think, you know, a place where he felt like we could both be honest, and we were honest, and it was sometimes brutal and sometimes not pretty, often not pretty. I think we hurt each other's feelings, and but that honesty eventually, you know, on the third trip, which was after the trip that ended outside of Houston, it took that third trip, and you know, by then probably about 4,000 miles on the road to get to a place of reconciliation.
You know, this issue of honesty is fascinating, especially when you are dealing with memoir, because there are always these questions, and there's one incident in particular that you and your father have distinctly different memories of. And I get the sense that you're both being entirely honest of what you remember about that day, but you do not remember the same thing.
No. And it's, we remember very nearly the same thing. And it's,
but the difference is really important in this story. Why don't you tell the story and then explain how the memories are different?
It's kind of grotesque, but I'll tell it. One of my chores as a child, I had many chores, and one of my chores was to pick up the dog waste in the backyard on a Saturday morning. And my father always inspected our work to make sure we'd, you know, done what we were supposed to. And I always feared these inspections. And this one day in particular, I failed. And I remember, you know, distinctly my father grabbing me by the back of the neck, and I was about 7 years old at the time. He would have been about 38, and dragging me across the yard and shoving my face, you know, within, you know, an inch of this pile of dog waste, and my father pointing out to me, you know, that I'd made this mistake. And it, of course, filled me with absolute terror. Not just the physical violence, but the psychological violence, and I confronted my father with this fact, and he at first he denied it, and then he tried to parse his words, and you know, he remembered it differently. That he was trying to point out to me that I'd made a mistake, that I had a responsibility to the family to complete my chores, and that he had simply pointed this error of mine out to me. And that's one of those, you know, memories, those moments that we will never agree on.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that I feel like my father must, the event must have troubled my father too, because he's an old man now and he still remembers it, and I think he knows that he crossed a line there.
You know, it's interesting to me because you write about after it happened, he sort of took you on his lap and said, even at the time when you were 7 years old, whatever it was, a couple of hours later, he said, look, you just got to understand. That to me feels like he felt very guilty.
Yeah, I think he did feel guilty. And this was a recurring event throughout my childhood when my father would be either verbally and or occasionally physically abusive, and it's kind of the lie of the dictator, basically. This hurts me more than it hurts you, and we all need to learn from this. But I think he was definitely shaken by his behavior on that day.
Steve in Dallas writes in an email, did your father have a favorite among you and your siblings?
Oh, I don't want to sound like the pouty son, but I think my father may have favored my older brother, and I know this because I don't mind it. You know, I loved my brother. He was a great guy. But I think it was for my father, you know, the firstborn son was very important to him, and his idea of history and the family moving forward and the family name moving forward, very important to my father. And when I, in fact, you know, confronted my father yet again about not attending my brother's funeral, my father's my father's excuse was that I would never know. There was nothing like the loss of losing his firstborn son. And he said, you know, I love you and I love your sisters, but there was nothing like losing your brother.
And that hurts.
And it hurt. And it hurt in many ways. And it haunted me because I thought, well, what would happen if I got hit by a bus tomorrow and die? Would my father show up at my funeral? number one. And then, and if he did, what would that mean? And if he didn't, what would that mean? It was maybe I was overthinking it, but it haunted me for a while.
No, it makes sense because there's that sense of, okay, you still have three children living. Why are we not good enough for you?
Yeah, we're here, and we're your family, and the only thing that my brother, who would have wanted, was for the family to go on, and for my father to to love us and take care of us.
You also lost your brother at exactly the age when so many adults come together with their siblings, and I know you do still have your sisters, but they come together and start sort of sorting out together what childhood was like.
Yeah, my brother was 8 years older than me, and he died. He was 35. He just turned 35, and I was 27. And it would have been that time when he had a family then. I didn't yet have a family, but it would have been. I think we were right on the cusp of those, those honest conversations about what it had been like to grow up in that household. And I miss my brother dearly, and I certainly miss him for losing that aspect of brotherhood. And there is. I do think that especially my family was very gender divided in sort of how we were raised, and
mm-hmm.
And I think there's something the different genders and families sort of experience the family differently.
Anthony Swofford is my guest. He's a novelist and memoirist. His new book is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Anthony Swofford. His new memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Anthony, talk about why you developed an interest in going to visit wounded veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars in Bethesda.
Sure, I was, when these wars started, I was a civilian, and I wrote about the first Gulf War, which was totally linked with these new wars, at least the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't gone over to report, but I felt like the important story for me and an important way to understand the wars was to spend some time around injured veterans and their families. And I was lucky enough to hook up with an organization called Disabled American Veterans, which is like the premier veteran service organization, and their focus is disabled veterans and policy and also the service, the care for them. But I made it to Bethesda under their umbrella, and I was heartbroken by the injuries that I saw, and a legacy of the new wars. But I was also pretty blown away, I have to say, by the spirit that I saw in those wards and the way that these young Marines and their families were trying to make sense of this new reality. And a sobering recognition that it was going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But also the recognition that same kind of spirit and service to country that had led them to join and serve in the first place was going to help them out in the future as they moved on from their injuries. And you know, one vet who I write about, who I visited, he was oblivion and had received his citizenship through military service. Had been in the Marine Corps for probably about 10 years. And he was a staff sergeant, and he'd been blown up and pretty badly. His legs were pretty tweaked, and he had some shrapnel wounds. But you know, all this staff sergeant wanted to do was to get back over there and fight again with his men. You know, he felt like he'd let them down by being injured, and he just wanted to be back over there again.
You write that you still fantasize about being back in combat, and specifically about killing.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that, and I'd finished my first book about 10 years after the first Gulf War, and I felt like I had put those urges behind me and that need behind me. But you know, in the wake of that book coming out, I ended up spending a lot of time around veterans and you know, even these injured guys. But I realized that I have a kinship with these young men, and that I understand very much that desire for combat and what the test of combat can mean, and again that adrenaline high and that excitement that comes from combat, and the camaraderie, the deep camaraderie that can't be replicated anywhere else. And for many years, that need still haunted me.
Is there something about that experience of combat that feels more authentic than the sort of everyday life where you run to the store and buy eggs and, you know, show up at work and change your baby's diaper?
It's much more authentic. I think it's much more authentic.
Why?
In terms of man. Well, because you're tested. You know, you're not necessarily tested running to the store to grab a carton of eggs.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in the military, you know, even not at combat, but especially at combat, you're tested. There's always a mission. There's always something that must be accomplished. And the mission is always greater than the individual.
Yeah.
And you know, even if you don't like a guy, you can usually trust him. You can trust that he's trained well, and that he's going to perform. And he can trust you too, and that you will support one another. And that's something that is not present out in the civilian world, and that causes a lot of distress for veterans. There's a lack of lack of trust is a real issue when it comes to returning and reintegrating into the world, and that's something that a lot of veterans have a lot of trouble with. That's what I hear a lot, is that they have trouble, you know, trusting people who haven't been through the same things that they have been.
I mean, what you've just described is probably the best explanation I have ever heard of why people want to go back. I think for those of us who have not served, we understand the honor and the valor and the service to one's country, but I think that whole issue of the sort of mission every day that's bigger than you are, and the trust, that it makes a kind of sense that I haven't heard before.
Yeah, it made sense to me, and even, you know, I thought I was... You know, I thought I'd clapped the erasers together in 1992 when I left the Marine Corps, and I was done. And then, but I wasn't done, and I wasn't done with. In some ways, you know, I'll admit a kind of romantic view of my past and of the men I served with, but also, you know, a very real camaraderie and kinship, and the idea that something must be accomplished. And that one has the means to do it, and that one has also the the company of like-minded people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I have a comment leading to a question. You know, when you grow up without adequate parenting, whether you lose a parent or whether you just have one that's just kind of bad, you don't develop what I call the voice. And the voice is that adult side of you. As you get older, you reach your 20s, that helps you negotiate adult issues, your feelings, helps you reflect on life. And clearly, you've developed it because you can't write these types of things without it. So my question is to you is, did you have this adult on board when you went into combat initially? Or talk a little bit about your development of your inner life a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I like this concept of the voice, and I think I'll steal it. Thanks. But I don't think I had that voice. The voice that I had in the Marine Corps was very particular, and it was about, you know, being well trained and knowing how to go into combat. And I came out, and I was 22, and I did not have that voice. It took me a while to find my writerly voice, and I found my writerly voice, and I had my subject, which was the Marine Corps and combat, and I was able to write that first book because of finding that voice. But I still don't think I had the adult voice, and I think you're absolutely right that the lack of proper parenting kind of retarded me in that way. Really, I was in my mid-30s, and I was in some ways behaving like a foolish teenager, and it took real crisis for me to finally find that voice and find that center and that balance, which I wish I'd discovered in my mid-20s.
You actually use the word saint when describing your mother, and she's not fully fleshed out here as a sort of character in this particular story. And I'm wondering if that's because you plan to write about her more extensively later, or because in that sense that, you know, happy families are alike in the same ways, she is less interesting as a subject because she did things right.
Yeah, I hate to say that my mother is less interesting as a subject than my father, but I think she is. I don't know that I'll write about her specifically again in nonfiction. I'm watching my wife be a mother, and the idea of motherhood and caretaking is fascinating to me. And my father's own loss of his mother, at the beginning of his life, was, I think, a defining loss for him. And I also think it's true that in the sort of the psychological world that we make as children, I had to make someone good, right? Because my father was not great, and we as siblings very much depended on my mother's goodness, and I think I'm comfortable with leaving it there.
Was it comforting to you when you struggled with the ways in which you were, in fact, similar to your father? Did you remind yourself on a regular basis, but I'm half my mom?
Yeah, I did. I in fact did, and I looked at my mother's history. Her parents were radically different. My grandmother was an artist, and my grandfather, my mother's father, was a mathematician, and her upbringing was radically different than my father's. My father was pretty rough and tumble, and my mom's was pretty lighthearted, and I know stories of that grandfather. I never met him. He died before I met. But I would think about him, and I would think about the anecdotes that my mother told about her father, and I would certainly and still do hope that that's the legacy that I pick up, and that's the fathering legacy that I continue.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Taylor in Fort Worth. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. I just wanted to tell Anthony how much I enjoyed his first book, and I both read it and listened to the book on tape, and I actually kind of liked the movie as well. I was a Navy doc with the Marine Corps for 2 years at the end of the Vietnam thing, and it certainly rings very true and authentic, and I'm not disappointed hearing his rather scholarly elocution today. He's very well spoken, Mr. Swofford, and I look forward to your other book. I'm sure it'll be very insightful. Being a lifelong marksman and being involved in competitive shooting, even in an older age as I am now, the particular point, I believe you say, that the man turns in the rifle at the armory and thinks he's finished with the rifle. Well, a true marksman, it doesn't work that way. And again, I just want to say how much I enjoyed your writing, and I look forward to reading your new book as well.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. The corpsmen do an amazing service for the Marines. They save lives, and in my time in the Marine Corps, our corpsman was really a de facto leader, and I call him Doc John in Jarhead, and I was lucky enough to spend some time with him in D.C. last week. An important guy in my life.
Do you continue to feel a special obligation to veterans, not only because you are one yourself, but because you have written this book that for so many people is really an important testament of what happened?
I do feel an obligation, and I'll admit, I think for the first few years after Jarhead came out, I didn't want to admit that or didn't want to feel it. But then I came to the conclusion, well, I wrote this book, and I am that guy. And I do have a platform, and veterans matter to me very much, and veteran causes do. And I hope to make my next book a nonfiction book, about returning veterans and the what happens to a guy when he's injured at Bethesda, and what life looks like after that. I think it's an important story, and I think I'm the one to tell it.
So your dad is not that old, but he's been quite ill for a long time. And throughout the book, you sort of allude to the fact that he, could die at any moment. Are you ready to lose him?
No, I'm not ready to lose him. I hope he's around.
I don't mean you're looking forward to it, but please understand the question.
If my father were to pass away soon, I would be comfortable with where we were, where our relationship is now. And, it was very important for me that he meet my daughter, and he spent some time around her now. And I feel like the circle has closed, and I'm now not just a son, I'm also a father. And I know that my father is pleased with that, and I am too. And I think it has both complicated and enriched our relationship.
You, it sounds like, have come to an understanding of him. Do you believe he really understands you even now?
I don't know that he does. I wish that he did, but I was in a car with him recently last week or so in California, and I don't think he totally gets me. I think he respects me, and he's proud of me, my life as a writer is something radically different than anything he did with his life, and he's interested in it, but... I'm not sure that he understands me, but maybe it's not the father's job to understand the son. Maybe it's the son's job to understand the father.
The new memoir by author Anthony Swofford is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Anthony, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate it. Appreciate your callers.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. If you want to learn more about the show or download the podcast, which comes out every day and is free, you can go online to kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions can be sent along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.